17, gusting to 28. Single digits, Racine 9 above, Kenosha 9 above, Windchill 14 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program is dedicated to two of the greatest creative geniuses in the history of television, Rod Serling and Lucille Ball. Part one is a newly recorded interview. Part two comes from the Morning Show archives. Here's part one. In this portion of today's morning show, we are remembering a television icon on the occasion of what would have been his 100th birthday. This past Christmas Day, December 25th, 2024, would have been the 100th birthday of Rod Serling, who sadly passed away at the age of 50 back in 1975. The son of a humble Jewish grocer, Rod Serling demonstrated exceptional gifts for writing and theater at an early age, and also from an early age was concerned with matters of justice. He served in the U.S. Army with great distinction during the Second World War, winning the Purple Heart, Bronze Star, and the Philippine Liberation Medal. Rod Serling later said that he turned to professional writing to help process all that he had experienced in combat. He began as a scriptwriter for radio and then shifted to television and wrote many fine scripts for live dramatic anthology series like Kraft Television Theater and Hallmark Hall of Fame, including the famed Requiem for a Heavyweight. He earned his greatest fame with The Twilight Zone, which ran on CBS for 5 seasons, and for which Rod Serling himself penned 92 of a total 156 episodes. He also had a creative hand in a distinctive series from a few years later called Night Gallery. He ended up earning multiple Emmy Awards for his fine work. Two books are being presented to the public in new editions that help illuminate his greatness as a writer. One of them is The Twilight Zone Companion, recently released in a third edition. This book by Silman James Press is by Mark Scott Zikri, who is arguably the world's foremost expert on The Twilight Zone. Also available to the public is a beautifully written memoir called As I Knew Him, My Dad, Rod Serling, written by his daughter, Ann Serling, published by Commonwealth Books. I had the great pleasure of recording a brief interview with both Ann Serling and Mark Scott Zikri. Ann Serling, I am so honored to be speaking with you, first of all, about your memoir, As I Knew Him, My Dad, Rod Serling. It's a lovely book, and you clearly have inherited some of your father's exceptional writing gifts, and I so appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. He has been gone a long time, having died back in 1975. What is it like to look back at your father's life with him gone that length of time? We can tell from the book that he remains a very, very vivid part of your life.
Absolutely, and thank you so much. Yeah, there isn't a day that my father doesn't float across my mind. It was and still remains a profound loss. I miss my dad. It's it's hard to imagine him being 100 years old. I don't think I'll be able to process that at all. My dad was so much fun. He was really, you know, of course I'm incredibly biased, but he was a lovely human being who deeply cared about other people and what was going on in the world. And the flip side of him was he was just funny and liked to pretend he was a gorilla in home movies. It was, and he liked shows like The Flintstones.
You know, one of the most amazing moments in your book is when you write this: I easily imagine my dad as a little boy, because even as an adult, there is something magically childlike about him, so endearingly silly, that I feel in some ways I knew the boy almost as well as I know the man, which is an amazing thing to say when we think about all the way we most vividly remember your dad, Rod Serling, is as someone who scarcely cracked a smile as he intoned those serious introductions to all of those Twilight Zone episodes or Night Gallery episodes. And so it's so great that you can give us that kind of insight that otherwise would never occur to the rest of us.
Yeah, I wrote in the eulogy that I wrote for him, you know, he was a little boy in so many ways. He never let go of the things that most of us do as we grow older. And that was just very incredibly endearing about him, too.
Mm. One thing that you say about your father and his relation to the medium of television, you write at one point, and this is shortly after the Twilight Zone had went off the air and so on, and you quote your father as saying, "Television has left me tired, frustrated." I mean, for all of his great success, there was frustration. What was at the heart of the frustration that he experienced in working in the field of television?
Well, I think it was he wanted to tell these important stories. He had wanted to tell the story about Emmett Till before he launched into the Twilight Zone. And it was very difficult for him with the censorship and the pressures. As he said, an alien could say what a Democrat or a Republican couldn't. And that's how he would slip these messages under the radar. But I think it was exhausting for him, as that would be for any writer. You know, he wasn't unique in that, but he felt that people needed to care about what was going on, and one of his quotes was, "A writer's job is to menace the public's conscience."
I love that. And of course, we learned so much about all of the work of substance that he did, even beyond The Twilight Zone, which, of course, he is best remembered for. One thing I learned from reading your memoir is all of the work that your father did as a teacher. I do not remember ever knowing that about him. Just say a quick word about why teaching was important to him, or maybe the way in which being a teacher was a reflection of some of his most central core values.
Well, I think you summed that up perfectly. And he once said that he felt that he learned more from the students than they learned from him. But, yeah, he loved working with students, and he worked at Ithaca College, Antioch College.
That's yet another legacy for which he can be very, very proud. Mark Scott Zickrey, the author of The Twilight Zone Companion, that's a book that is on my bookshelf at home. We should mention that it's now available in a third edition, and I'll ask you about that in just a moment. I would love for you to share with our listeners your experience of first seeing The Twilight Zone when you were just 8 years old, and you make passing reference to actually two televisions. Explain that wonderful bit.
Well, when I was a little kid, Twilight Zone was on past my bedtime, but one evening, my stepfather allowed me to stay up late, and he was kind of a tinkerer, a handyman, so he would repair things in our garage. And he had two TV sets up on a high shelf. One that got all picture, just picture. The other one got just sound. And they were on, both of them were on, but to different stations. So that was a Twilight Zone experience in itself, having different programs playing at the same time. And I looked up, and there were these men in a spaceship, and they landed on the alien planet and found a wrecked copy of their own spaceship, and inside that were their own dead bodies, copies of them. And this is a great Twilight Zone episode called Death Ship, one of the hour ones that was made during Twilight Zone's fourth season. And that was an episode written by Richard Matheson and starring Ross Martin and Jack Klugman. I didn't know any of that at the time. I didn't even know what show it was, but it just caught my attention immediately. And then when I was a little older, you know, 9, 10 years old, Twilight Zone went into syndication, and then it was airing in the afternoons every day on KTLA here in Los Angeles, and I would just watch it religiously, and it was one of my favorite TV shows ever, and still is, of course.
Right.
And one thing that was great about Twilight Zone, and Anne touched on this, is that one of the great obligations of a writer is to keep your heart open to the world, because there's so many things that can create scar tissue, all these working with the networks and battling those battles. But Rod kept every aspect of himself open, so he could be a boy-like, he could be childlike, and write the Walking Distance, this great episode about going back to his childhood. He could also keep his empathy and his compassion for other people. And so he was the full package. I mean, all of humanity is what he wanted to write about, and that's what he succeeded to do in Twilight Zone.
In this, you wrote this book at a time when, as far as you could tell at least, no such book existed that examined the series and episode by episode. And you tell us how you managed to secure the cooperation of Rod Serling's widow, Carol Serling, and you did it essentially by getting to work on the book before you even went to her and could present her with all kinds of interviews you had already conducted with the writers and actors and so on. When she opened up his treasure trove, what did that mean to you in terms of being able to complete this amazing book?
It was so wonderful. You know, that Rod died in 1975 when I was 19, and it was just like getting an electric shock. I mean, he did feel like a member of the family. He was so beloved by everyone. And so 2 years later, I was just right out of college. I was, you know, 21 years old, and I wanted to be a writer, producer, and TV, but I didn't know how to learn those skills. And I thought, if I write a show about the great, you know, a book about the greatest show ever made, maybe I can learn these skills. And also, I loved Twilight Zone. I wanted to delve deep into it. But I knew that with one short story to my credit and then a degree in painting, sculpture, and graphic arts, I wasn't going to get very far with Rod's widow, Carol, agreeing to let me write about Rod and the Twilight Zone. I didn't have anything to recommend myself. So I actually interviewed 30 people who worked on the Twilight Zone before I even approached Carol. And I heard she'd already turned down major writers who wanted to write about Rod. And so I thought, well, I spent 3 months interviewing 30 people who'd worked on the show, actors, directors, writers, producers. And then I went to Carol. And Rod's house was exactly as he'd left it. There was one room that was just the Emmys and the Hugo Awards and the Peabody Awards. And even his dog was there. His office was still there, everything. And his files, his scrapbooks. It was amazing. And I pitched my idea for how I wanted to do the book. And clearly she talked to some of the people she trusted that I had already interviewed, like Buck Houghton, the great producer of The Twilight Zone. And they must have given me a clean bill of health, because she then said, yes, you've got access to everything.
It's an amazing book. It really, really is. You have a lot to be proud of.
Thanks.
Mark Scott Zickrey and Anne Serling, thank you so much for being my guests today. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Anne Serling's memoir is titled As I Knew Him, My Dad, Rod Serling, published by Commonwealth Books. And Mark Scott Zickrey's book, The Twilight Zone Companion, in a third edition, is published by Silman James Press. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part two of today's program, we're replaying an excerpt from an interview I recorded back in 2020 with award-winning writer Darren Strauss, talking about his novel, The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story. This is a novel, and this is a work of fiction, but it is very much based on the life and legacy of Lucille Ball. It turns out that Darren Strauss's grandfather, Isidore Strauss, quite conceivably crossed paths with Lucille Ball in the 1950s, when she was at the height of her fame, an important figure in early television history, but with a very unhappy personal life. And Darren Strauss imagines what it might have been like for these two people from two very different worlds to have found each other. The book is published by Random House. Before we talk about your choice to create this possibility at the heart of this book, let's learn more about who your grandfather actually was, and for that matter, your grandmother, and what they were like, what they did, where they lived, whatever you think is important for us to know about them.
Yeah, so my great-grandfather, my grandfather's father, it's sort of a typical immigrant story. He came over here at the turn of the century with nothing. He was from Russia, and his older brother was here, and he was 13, and he was sent here because there was some hardship back home, so he came to America in 1900, and at 13 arrived at Ellis Island in New York, and his brother wasn't there. He didn't show up. So it was a 13-year-old kid with no money and no English, and he walked off into New York City, and somehow 20 years later he walked out a millionaire. I mean, it was a real American story. He worked really hard. He somehow got into real estate and then ended up owning all these buildings in New York City. And I say that my grandfather then had the singular talent of somehow being able to inherit a number of high-rises in Manhattan and still end up flat broke. It's almost impossible to lose money at the rate my grandfather did. He was just a terrible businessman. So by the time I arrived, there was nothing left of this sort of family fortune that my great-grandfather had built up. And it was because my grandfather wanted to be a poet. And his father said, no, you have to take over the family business. And he did. You know, he was an old-fashioned guy, and he was told he had to respect his father. And so he did what his father said and then drove the business into the dirt. So I, you know, was always sort of moved by that and became a writer maybe in response to that. And, you know, my grandfather did meet Lucille Ball at this party, and so I was always intrigued by that. And the party happened to have been thrown, and this is the beginning of the book, the party happened to have been thrown by Donald Trump's father. So Donald Trump's father bought a bunch of land in New York's Coney Island. And one of the things he owned was this really beautiful glass and steel landmark. And it was called the Palace of Fun. And it was a really important, beautiful building. So Trump's father wanted to tear it down and make crappy housing, as you know, developers did. So in order to avoid scandal, Trump Sr. Invited a bunch of real estate people, like my grandfather, and a bunch of celebrities, like Lucille Ball, to this beach in Coney Island, and invited the press. And at the stroke of midnight, the celebrities threw bricks through this glass building and destroyed it. And the press took photos, and everyone thought, "Wow, that's a really glamorous thing." And sort of elided over the fact that an important part of America was destroyed. So I thought that was sort of a very novelistic and cool opening, and it was true. And the funny thing is, I started writing the book before, I mean, this book took me a long time to write, so I started writing this book before Trump had even declared for president. So it seemed just like a cinematic opening when I first started writing it, and now there's so many more political implications that it seems, I got lucky in that I guess it seems more resonant even than I had planned when I started writing it.
Hmm. So tell us how well you knew your grandfather. I mean, I guess I should start with, did you know your grandfather? Did he live long enough to be any kind of meaningful part of your life and for you to have actually personally known him?
He was, and I really loved him, and my whole family loved him, and that was one of the interesting things about him was that he did these things that you'd think would be hard to forgive, and somehow my family kept forgiving him, and I think it was sort of because of his charm. So he abandoned my grandmother, left her, and she spent the last 30 years of her life as a hermit and an alcoholic in the house that they shared, and the sad thing. And so he left her, actually, he left my grandmother for her best friend and lived with her best friend as a kind of common law marriage for 3 decades. And one of the saddest things I've ever witnessed was I was there in my grandmother's deathbed. She was in hospice, and she was talking to the nurse about her husband as if they were still married, and that's just the way she conducted her life for the last 30 years. She just pretended they were still married. I mean, she not only forgave him, she acted as if it never happened, and I found that fascinating. And as I said, my grandfather drove his once prosperous business into the ground, and my entire family, except for me, is in real estate. So my uncle, my cousin, my father, every man in the family, for some reason, the women didn't pursue it, but every man in the family is in real estate except for me. And my father and uncle were quite good at it. And when my grandfather was losing his business, everyone sort of assumed he would ask his sons to help him. And he never did, and that really hurt them. And then, you know, the family business was destroyed. And still my father and my uncle completely love my grandfather and have no ill will. And so I just think it's really interesting how charm and personality can sort of mask all these things that people might do. And so that was another thing I wanted to examine.
Hmm. So the question is, in terms of crafting this novel and putting at the heart of it the possibility of your grandfather, in fact, having had an affair with the one and only Lucille Ball. First of all, I assume that you talked with members of your family about this possibility. How was this idea received by others in your family who knew your grandfather and might understandably have had some concerns about what it would mean to create a story with your grandfather playing this kind of role?
There's a Yiddish saying, which is, a family is doomed when a writer is born into it. So I think that there's maybe some truth in that. You know, my family was fine with it for the most part because I'm pretty clear that it's a novel. And, you know, I think my grandfather did cheat on my grandmother and abandoned her. And so, you know, I think this was a way for the whole family to sort of work through that. But yeah, there are some people who are not going to read it and are angry with it. I think, you know, you ruffle some feathers when you do stuff like this. But the interesting thing for me is I feel closer to both my grandparents now than I did when I started writing it. There's a saying from the writer Amy Hempel, a devil on the page, an angel to the reader. And I think that means if you write someone and show their flaws, the reader can appreciate that person and come to love them even more because no one is perfect. And so if you write a perfect character, the reader isn't going to sort of believe or fall in love in any way with that character. So I, you know, in dealing with my grandfather's flaws, I had to sort of give him due process and write about him and say, well, why was he like this? And so I think it's a really fair picture of him. And my grandmother was a very small part of the story when I first started writing it. But in writing the story, I realized I had a lot of unresolved feelings towards her, and she ended up becoming kind of the hero of the book in a way. I mean, when I grew up, she was, as I said, an alcoholic, and she was a very mean drunk. So I loved my grandfather, even though he had, you know, walked out on her and done all these things. And I didn't really feel that close to my grandmother. But, you know, in writing this, I realized, well, she grew up she was an adult in a very hard time for women and had to deal with ignorance about a lot of things. I mean, we didn't know that much about alcoholism in the 60s and 70s, or not as much about how to deal with it. So no one ever tried to get her help or anything. So I ended up really coming to feel closer to both of them. So I think people in my family have had concerns and then read the book and feel like, okay, well, this is a fair picture of everybody. Same thing with Lucille Ball fans. Actually, I heard from someone who was friends with Lucille Ball. This guy, what's his name? Jeffrey Tannen, who wrote a book about his friendship with her. And he said, you know, how dare you tell this story? And I said, well, may read the book before you condemn it. And he just wrote me and said, yeah, I think it's a beautiful sort of love letter to her. So, you know, as you said, I think I've won over a lot of skeptics.
Hmm. And I think one of the intriguing things about it, and by the way, my skepticism before I read the book had more to do with kind of this genre of fact and fiction blending versus this idea of creating this affair, a fictional account of an affair that may or may not have ever occurred. But I can see how someone else, loyal either to the memory of your grandfather or loyal to Lucille Ball, might resent that possibility. I think one of the things you do that I appreciate is that you create this in the most possible, most positive terms possible. That is, this is not something that happens out of recklessness or selfishness or anything like that. And not that you exactly paint it as a good thing that should have happened, but we understand, in a sense, why it happened, and from both directions. At one point in the book, I think you're quoting some great writer I think it's Proust, saying the prospect of infidelity is the key to marriage. I'd never read that before. I wonder if you could just say a word about how you think that tends to be true, and how it was perhaps true in this specific instance.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I came across that quote, and I thought it was really interesting, and I'm not, but I wasn't sure it was true, and I have my character question it too, because the idea, I guess, is that for a spouse to remain engaged, the spouse should think, well, this person's still appealing to other people, and so I have to keep my game going in order to make sure that they don't stray. And that seems maybe a very French way of looking at marriage. But I think, having been married now for quite some time, I've been married since 2004, I don't know if that's true. It's complicated. Maybe it's true for some people. I also think if you suspect your spouse of straying, you might be so angry you'd leave. But for my character, it was a way of sort of thinking about the morality of the situation. He was trying to convince himself that he wasn't a bad person. So what I found interesting about my grandfather in this story was he was very concerned with morality and wanted to be a good person, and yet was having this extramarital affair, and so did all this sort of mental gymnastics to convince himself he wasn't doing wrong. And it's funny, you very kindly mentioned that you thought the one thing that worked in the book was that I don't condemn anybody, that I give everyone a sort of fair shake, showing them doing things that might be morally dubious. And I think that's the job of literature. I mean, there's a great quote from Saul Bellow, the Nobel Prize-winning American writer. And he said, when you write, you become familiar with due process. You have to give all your characters due process. And I think that means if you're a good writer, you want to be a defense attorney for your villains. And so that means say, yeah, he did bad things, but here's why. And maybe even be a prosecutor against your heroes. Because, again, you don't want to write a perfect person. So you want to say, yeah, she's a really good character, but here's maybe an area where she's not perfect. And so if you do that, you end up showing people in all their messiness, because I think we're all complex, and so there's no really a delineation between he's a great person and she's a terrible person, or vice versa. I mean, there are certainly terrible people, but for the most part, we're a mixture of good and bad, I think.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Darren Strauss, and we are talking about his newest book, which is called The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story. And it occurs to me that in all of this time, we have not yet really talked very much about Lucille Ball herself, and that's what we're going to do now for the next few minutes. First of all, tell us about your own relationship with Lucille Ball. Not that you ever knew her. I assume you didn't. But what you have thought of her over the years, and if anything in particular drew you to her as a key figure in one of your books.
Yeah. I'm glad to have the opportunity to talk about her, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I mean, I was a teenager when she died, so I didn't really... And, you know, her show, her great show, she had four TV shows, but her really great, famous show ended 10 years before I was born, so I only got to know her in reruns. But even then, I knew how famous she was. I mean, as I mentioned a little earlier in the show, her show was so popular, it's really hard to fathom now. The most popular television show now is NCIS, which I think gets about 9 million viewers a week. She had 10 times that, as I mentioned, so that's just an incredible amount of viewership. I mean, 75% of homes with TVs watched her. Not even 75% of viewers, 75% of homes with TVs, that counts people who are out to dinner. So, you know, something like 85% of people who are home watching TV watched her, which is just incredible. But that's only sort of the tip of the iceberg. Another really fascinating, cool thing she did is she forced CBS to air an interracial marriage. I mean, she was married to a Cuban guy, and it's funny the way definitions change, because actually today it might not be considered interracial because he was Cuban of Spanish heritage, and so it's probably considered Caucasian, but back then it was considered an interracial marriage, and CBS said, absolutely not, we're not going to let you have a Cuban husband, we have a white blonde man picked out for you. And she said, no, I really want to be with my husband. And so she forced them to do it, and then America really embraced this couple, and I think that probably helped racial attitudes progress a little bit in this country.
Hmm.
And the funny thing is she did it not for any grand social reason, but because she knew he would cheat on her if she wasn't with him all the time. So she said, I want Desi to be in the show, because she figured if I'm off filming without him, he'll cheat. And the sad thing is he cheated anyway. So part of the reason I wrote the book, too, was to give her measure of revenge. I mean, in the middle of her fame, he was caught with two prostitutes in Confidential magazine, you know, which is the basis of the movie L.A. Confidential, did this big expose about him and all his affairs. And so it was really publicly humiliating for her. But you know, she's a very powerful, cool figure. She also was an executive, the first female mogul in Hollywood. She owned more studio space at the end of her career than any studio, and was a really good executive. I mean, no one else in Hollywood wanted to take a chance on Star Trek, and she did. And so the reason we have Star Trek, which led to Star Wars, which led to basically modern blockbuster entertainment, is because she took a chance on this weird show that was pitched to her as the UN in space. And she said, that sounds good. You see, all the networks said, that sounds really weird. No, thank you. So I thought that I just think she's just a fascinating figure in many ways, and really wanted to get her story out there.
Explain to our listeners the title, The Queen of Tuesday.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it's fiction, and so I really wanted to make sure that people did not think this was a biography. And I wanted to make sure people knew this was fiction and not, you know, fake news, as they say. So her show was on Monday night. And I, in order to show the reader that this is a novel, I changed it to some facts and mentioned at the end that I did that. So I put her show on Tuesday night. And I thought it was just a cool title. I originally was going to have her on Monday night. And then I thought The Queen of Monday is just a bad title. People hate Mondays, so no one wants to read a book called The Queen of Monday. So I changed it to The Queen of Tuesday and then changed the day of her show. And that was a sort of wink to her big fans to say, yes, I know this is fiction.
Hmm. I think one of the best choices that you make among many in this book is that where the story begins is at such a pivotal point in her life and career, a point when things are not going very well, and her extraordinary and groundbreaking success with I Love Lucy was still in the future and by no means assured. Explain to our listeners what was going on with Lucille Ball professionally at this point in time when your novel begins with that extraordinary party on the beach hosted by Fred Trump. What was going on with Lucille Ball professionally at that point in time, and for that matter, with her husband Desi Arnaz as well?
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, one of the things I admire most about her is her determination. I think that's what people respond to. I'll tell her history really quickly. She, at 16 years old, lived in a very small town in upstate New York and ran away and came to New York City to become famous and was sent home by a producer who said, "You don't have it. You're not pretty. You're not talented. You're never going to be famous. Go home." And she ran away 10 times from high school and kept trying, kept coming back, and never made it in New York City. And then she said, "Okay, I'm going to go to L.A. and try to make it in Hollywood." And then barely made it. I mean, she took many years to get into movies, and then she did get into movies, but never as a big star, and then started to fail there. She had been in a bunch of B-movies and for a brief time was called the Queen of the Bees, which is a sort of derogatory term for success, meaning that she could be in bad movies but never good ones. And even that she didn't succeed at for long because she was fired from MGM and then went to RKO and was fired from RKO. And she had been on the radio then and then failed at the radio. The radio show wasn't going so well. So her last chance at fame was TV, which at this point was a pretty iffy proposition. No one knew if TV could really make it. So it's hard to imagine now, but from 16 to 40, she was a failure and just kept trying. And she said about herself, "You know, I don't know why I'm famous. I'm not the best actress. I can't write jokes. I'm not a great singer. I can't sing. I can't dance. I'm not the prettiest." And this, is, remember, was the 50s when, you know, a female actress, when actresses' looks were very important. I mean, it's hard now for actresses to overcome that, but think about it in the 50s. So all these things were stacked against her, and she just kept trying. And I think she was a brilliant comic actress, but she needed all the right elements to be in place in order for that to work. And it was really just her determination that kept her going. And I think she realized that. And so if you think about the show is about a woman who's not that talented, always trying to become famous, always trying to get into Desi's show. And so I think it was playing out her life in some way.
Interesting. I've actually never, ever stopped to think about that for the hundreds of times I've watched I Love Lucy over the years. I think you're absolutely right.
I never did either. It was only in writing it that I realized, oh, my God, this is her life.
Yeah, interesting. At one point, you have her thinking to herself with MGM having terminated her contract. After 20 bit part years, although still kind of young, she's also probably washed up. And that has to be so painful and so scary for a performer at that point in their career, tasting some success, but not as much success as they knew was possible, and fearing that that's all the success they're ever going to have, and that from here it is going to be a slow slide into obscurity. And this has to be, a really frightening prospect. The picture you paint of Desi Arnaz is also of one of frustration, that things have not panned out to the extent that he hoped. And at one point, you have him, or someone thinking to himself, like everyone who has lost or nearly grabbed real success, Desi Arnaz considers himself wronged by the world. And of course, to whatever extent that's true, that might also help to some extent explain why he lived the life that he did, or lived life the way he did.
I think exactly right. Yeah, I mean, that's an easy thing for, I think, any creative person can easily feel that way. You know, I think as a writer, I've certainly had those fears all the time. I think it's just something everyone fears, even those who are successful. I mean, I remember, I can't remember who said this quote. It might have been Auden or someone, but I think the quote was, every successful career looks like a failure from the inside. Because you know all the times you got bad reviews or came close to getting something. And in her case, it was true. She really was close to failure at that point. And then, amazingly, a year later had success unprecedented in this country. I mean, she really was probably the most famous woman in the history of America at that point, by some measures. And right before that, she was a failure. And I feel like that's an uplifting kind of American story, too, that, you know, there is hope. So I really, really wanted to examine that, too, the feeling of failure right before success and insecurities and confidence and how those all play into each other.
Mm. And, of course, the plan that Lucy and Desi have at that point is to try to hatch this this new project that will be a creative partnership for them. And it's not just a matter of looking for success, but as you said earlier, it is also, as far as Lucille Ball is concerned, perhaps the only path to saving her marriage. She thinks at one point working with her husband was the only chance she'd have to dust off her marriage and get it back on her feet. Something else I want to ask you specifically about is something that is said at this memorable party on the beach hosted by Fred Trump, the father of our current president, and something that he says that speaks, I think, so powerfully to the place of women in the world of entertainment at this point in time. I'm just going to read this passage, if you don't mind. So Fred Trump has walked up to the microphone, and as you said earlier, at this memorable moment, everyone, all these party guests are going to be throwing bricks and, in a sense, destroying this building. But ahead of that happening, he's at the mic. "Gentlemen," he says, and the fat microphone crackles. He is ignoring the light rain. "Thank you for coming. And ladies, can't forget them. They're too expensive." General laughter, except for Lucille. "No, that's what we are," she thinks, "in this year of our grace, 1949. Expensive adornments, investments, showpieces." Forming the thought even as she orders herself to smile. Because men are where you sink your youth and hopes, with all their sturdiness, caution, their slowness to engage. They're hard to motivate. Oxen. She'd like to broadcast something that gets this across, but also funny. How to make a man do what you want. And even when he sees your stratagem, and even if you give him the consolation prize of thinking you're a fool, you've still got what you want. So wrapped up in those words is the kernel of the idea for, of course, I Love Lucy. But ahead of that, I think you are speaking so perceptively, and it's not the only time in the book, that we are shown inside some of the frustration and hurt that Lucille Ball is feeling at this point in time as a woman of ambition and creativity in an entertainment world that is run almost entirely by men, and many of them with very outdated ideas about what women are capable of. Can you just speak to that important element in the story of Lucille Ball and this book?
Yeah, and first of all, your voice is so amazing that I'd love to hear you read more of it. You make the book sound better than it is, so thank you. I think if you write about people different from yourself as a novelist, you have to really jump into their heads and be respectful. You know, I think that, you know, if you're a man writing about a woman, or if you're writing about someone of different ethnicity, you have to be really respectful, especially in this moment when we're sort of examining all that stuff. And so the way to justify telling stories about people different from yourself is to really try to think about their position. And so I wanted to sort of write, to justify writing about a woman, I felt like I had to almost write a feminist novel in a way. And so I had to really think about, okay, what is it like being a woman? And so The reason I think fiction is important and literature is important is because it can teach you empathy. And as a writer, I learned to be, I think, more empathetic toward starlets and certainly and probably women in general by having written this book. I mean, I think, you know, it was very hard. It's always hard, I think, to be a woman, but it was harder then in 1949. So I really had to try to put myself in those high heels and try to think, okay, what is it like?
Mm. A last question, and I wish we had more time to give you to talk about this. At one point, we read these words: "If you want to know a person, learn what she keeps herself from remembering." So when we want to really know Lucille Ball, what are the things that she kept herself from remembering?
Oh, good question. She had a very difficult childhood. Her father died when she was very young. And right as she heard he died, the window was open and a bird flew in the house. And so she hated birds for the rest of her life. And that seemed very cinematic to me, that image of the bird flying through her window. But it wasn't just that her father died. It was that her mom then immediately remarried and left her, went off to the Midwest to try to find a job. So she was in upstate New York, and her mom went to Detroit to try to find work with her new husband. And so she left Lucille with her step-grandparents. And so here's this girl who just lost her father, and then her mom leaves her, not even with her grandparents, but her step-grandparents and new step-grandparents. And so that's really hard for a kid, and I think that's probably why she tried so hard to become famous. I think she needed that love because she didn't have it growing up, and to such a great degree had known loss and loneliness. So, and she did not like to talk about that or think about it, and so that, I think, was the key to her.
Hmm. And a key to this story of supposed infidelity between Lucille Ball and your grandfather in that fictional kernel of the book, you write in one of the moments when they are first meeting, and Lucille Ball is thinking of this excitement, "It was lovely to remind yourself that life can still surprise you." One of my favorite lines from this book that I really loved start to finish, again called "The Queen of Tuesday, a Lucille Ball story," published by Random House and the author Darren Strauss. Darren Strauss, congratulations on creating an absolutely terrific book. I am so glad that I got to read it, and I'm so glad that we got to talk about it. Very best wishes to you.
Oh, thank you so much. And it was really lovely, and I'm glad you liked the book. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview with a recent Carthage graduate, relatively recent Carthage graduate, Mike Storman, who was a contestant on Wheel of Fortune. We will hear all about what it's like to be a contestant on one of television's most popular game shows. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. From WGTD's Arts and Other Events calendar, tomorrow is the first day of the third annual Arts Symposium at Carthage College. It is titled "Peace, Parity, A New Cold War, Navigating Global Dynamics in the 21st Century." And the very first event is tomorrow morning. Carthage's Peter Thomas, who is a cellist with the Milwaukee Symphony, is going to be performing an extraordinary work by Sergei Prokofiev, Prokofiev's Cello Sonata. And this work was written for the great Mstislav Rostropovich, and Peter Thomas actually studied with one of Rostropovich's own pupils. So it's a marvelous opportunity to encounter a great masterpiece, and this performance is free. Tomorrow, that is Tuesday morning, 11 a.m. in Carthage's Recital Hall. The public is welcome. Partly sunny today, and windy and very cold, a high today of just 17 degrees. Our overnight low drops to 2 above. Tomorrow sunny and even colder with a high of just 15 degrees. Wednesday sunny with a high of 22, and we warm up into the upper 30s for a high by Thursday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.